So to introduce our speakers, we have Peter Yates, who is a researcher and writer for the film. Peter is also an anthropologist, and he spent the last 20 years living and working in Central and Northern Australia, working alongside First Nations people with a strong focus on land and resource management issues. We're also joined by Auntie Steph Armstrong, who's featured in the film. And she's a Gamilaroi woman from northern New South Wales, but currently living and working in Bendigo, Victoria. She's a mother, sister, auntie, and proud nana of one. And we're also joined by Jana Lenaz. Jana's the CEO of Environment Victoria, and he's spent nearly 20 years organizing with the environment movement, including 11 years with Friends of the Earth, where he led the River Red Gum campaign, and with Australian Conservation Foundation, where he led campaigns around the creation and the implementation of the Basin Plan. So I guess my first question is for Peter. I'll just kick it off with a few, but then folks feel free to post questions and we'll weave them in. So Peter, I really like the story of how the film came into being. And you've talked about seeing the footage of the Murray cod after the Menindee fish kills. And from what it sounds like, pretty much just getting into the car with your son, Rory, who's the director of the film. I'm interested in if you could talk about when you knew that this project, this investigation and interest would be a film, and what sort of story you were looking to capture that you felt other media was missing. What were you looking to add?
Well, yeah, we were sitting here these days living in Malden, and it just happens that the director and cinematographer for this film is my son, Rory. And that that video from Tolano Station, Rob McBride and Dick Arnold in the river picking up dead cod, and, you know, this was just harrowing stuff. We're just looking at that and seeing what, just need to do something different. And I said, we just need to go, get in the car, let's just go and document this. So Rory's a filmmaker, he's got all the gear. And I'm an anthropologist, and I just had a real sense that, you know, the media was telling us about the dead fish, and they were not telling us about the impact of that fish kill event on the Indigenous people, on the First Nations people who live along that river. And so within, I don't know, within an hour, we'd packed the car and we were gone. And, you know, the mere 7 or 8 hour drive up to Menindee to start chasing down the story and filming, a process that then, you know, took many, many weeks to finish. And I'm sure we could be up there even now.
Yeah. There's an interesting sort of movement in the documentary. And in a lot of ways, I think it kind of mirrors the experience of trying to understand what's happening in the basin. The film starts with a dry riverbed and talking about the power of the river and what it means and the sustenance that it provides and the gravity of the theft of the river. And then maybe 15 minutes in, we get all the terms with gigaliters, sustainable diversion limit adjustment mechanism, efficiency measures, and all the rest. And so I'm interested in how you and Rory navigated through the jargon, and what questions were guiding your story, and how did you keep your bearings through wading through all the complexity and detail of the basin?
To some degree, we didn't keep our bearings. We did our best, but, you know, it was incredibly complicated. So we headed out there and we started talking to people and we started hearing this jargon that we really weren't familiar with. And so the brain's going 19 to the dozen trying to make sense of it. And all the while I'm thinking, there's people hurting, and those are the First Nations people, and their story needs to be told. And yet, all the while, you can hear this other stuff, you know, the stuff of governments, the stuff of bureaucrats, the stuff of irrigators, this other language. And you can see right from the word go that First Nations people have no access to this language. I mean, I've barely got access to this language and I've got a PhD. You know, it's so specialized, it's so alienating that there's no way that your average person in Brewarrina is going to get their head around this talk. And so we just realized as we went that we needed to talk to this person, we needed to talk to that person, and we built up a picture from those conversations. And you see a film, it took 52 minutes. We have, I forget now, it's more like 9 hours of interviews of people, black and white, lots of people. We have something like 9 hours of interviews, some of the most harrowing 9 hours you could spend in your life, really. Just talking to people about how this affected them or what was going on. And what was very clear is the white fellas all had a really, complicated story about why it had to be this way or why it shouldn't be this way or what was really going on. And the Aboriginal side, there was almost no understanding of what had happened, why it had happened, who was benefiting. All they knew is that something had been stolen from them. And and this was up and down the river. And so you start to see that you have at a cultural level, you have a complete disjuncture between, there's no communication going on. People don't even begin to understand what's happened.
Yeah.
And I suppose, Pete, it's because when you're living, I'm from Coleraine-de-Bry and I haven't, lived at home for a long while. I'm down in Victoria now. But it's, again, when you're just surviving and, you're fighting for, just the right to live in some of those places, it's, again, politicians and bureaucrats and that make it difficult for us. Do you know what I mean? To wade through and to have, at a time where relationships are really important for Aboriginal people, that's the core of the whole thing. And we trust people would do the right thing, but time and time again, and, we've seen of late that frustration of being left out of conversations and, pushed into a corner, people either just curl up and die, or people come out fighting and angry about that, And so we try to find our way through that, I think. And like you said, it's all people along the river. So, it's, at all levels, isn't it? And especially then once you get corruption in amongst that and people, when money is put into place, then we miss out.
And you mentioned money. One of the things that I was shocked about was the amount of money involved in this. We have a cotton industry worth in the order of $1.5 to $2 billion a year. And we have we've got investors in water and investors in cotton growing for whom $100 million is just nothing. And then you have First Nations people who have nothing, who don't even own the house they live in. The disparities along the river are shocking. And this is all about, this is all made possible by the theft of that water. And, it's not enough that those Indigenous people don't have that they don't have an expectation of a long life or a good livelihood. It's not enough. We had to take the water as well. We had to take their river from them in order to turn it into mega wealth for a few. I didn't know about this, and I'm still staggered by that.
And I mean, and I told you this story, like in my time, right up until I went to university, I was still You know, we worked on the cotton farms. Do you know what I mean? We were labour there. So there were, you know, gangs of, you know, well, that's the term they use of a gang is of Aboriginal workforce who worked, you know, because it was labouring workforce through those cotton industry. And, you know, I can remember being at the side and they would spray us, you know, and many of our family have passed away from cancer. And, you know, we couldn't get any, there was no discussion on that all those years ago as Aboriginal people. So, you know, so that's been 40 years later. Now we're looking at the river again, you know, when, you know, like no one even cared then. Do you know what I mean? As we lost many of our family to cancer and a whole range of things that went through the court. Oh, sorry, something happened there. Did you hear me? Sorry.
Yeah, we heard you. It just tapped out for a second.
About the health
that was weird.
And then it was muted. It's interesting. There's that moment where, well, a lot of the things Bruce Shillingsworth's talking about in particular is about that back and forth between the material presence of water and the ceremony that keeps that relationship intact. And it seems, I don't know, I'm interested if you have any thoughts, Steph, on that. I know some of the work you've been doing to bring women together and sharing ideas of practices around water.
Yeah, look.
What's the role of practice?
Yeah, look, last Easter, my sister and a group of women, it was probably eight or nine, organised, and they organised from women from Queensland all the way down. It was just a call out to First Nation women, and from women all along came. And we had, we had over 100 registered, but we got about 60, 65 sort of women meet there in Walgett, you know, which sits right on the river. And, I was born not far from Walgett in a little place called Collarindabri. And it was just about women, you know, First Nation women having the time to be together, because we have no voice in that space. And yet when people, you know, I remember people carting water from here up because there were, you know, First Nation women from here that were taking water up home and, you know, all that sort of instance of, was happening. And I just couldn't get over just the idea of, you know, you need water to make babies' bottles. You know, really simple things of stuff where you know, when people think about farming and all that stuff and money, it didn't get back to some of those things as women where we're looking after children and grandchildren and the use of water for in that process, but also that many times that I work as a teacher, and so I've been an educator for many years, and so it has become, it's a stressful job teaching in Aboriginal space, I suppose. And for years I used to go back home, and I thought I'd be able to, you know, be really creative and do things. And all I would do is sit by the river, and it'd literally just calm me down, and I'd be able to then go back and work in schools and in systems that used to be always taking away from me my own identity. But the river, when I went home, was just that thing of being able to calm, and I couldn't think. It was just, the river is something that just washes you and, you know, makes you feel at peace. I'm one of those fishermen that throw the fishing rod, you know, I only use a hand line, sorry, but I throw the line in and then read a book or lay looking at the trees. So often I would like, you know, my sisters and that would complain that my fishing line would go down the water, you know, down the river while I was laying there. So it's much more than, you know, what often people think about. It is a space which is, and I think one of the elders had sort of said, you know, it runs in our blood, you know, it's that core of who river people are, you know. And the stories told there by my mother along there, like, again, we've gone back and time again and, You know, I've taken my granddaughter up a couple of times already. And, you know, now you just think you can't do, you know, like we used to go with my mum and you'd sit in the water and yarn and play. And now I haven't got that opportunity for my granddaughter. You know, it's, yeah.
Yeah, so we did a session about a week ago with Emma Carmody, the senior solicitor from the Environmental Defender's Office, joined us on that session. And one of the things that Emma said as a lawyer was that the Water Act and the Native Title Act don't talk to each other. And that the Water Act is inherently racist in the sense that it assumes that anyone has the ability to buy into the market, to own water. And of course, it assumes a certain value of water. So it doesn't say water is a good thing to have floating past and have fish in it. It assumes that water is better out of the river growing a crop. And, you know, in the light of what Steph's talking about here, it really strikes me that the violence that is inherent in that thinking where we separate water from land, where we separate water from self, from dreaming, from the very, very most basic way First Nations people think about the land. You know, they've been given, the Barkindji people have native title over the Barka, over the Darling River, and yet they don't own the water that flows down that river. What violence is that? What, you know, what thinking can even begin to get their head around that type of thing? So, yeah, I don't know whether you've got any thoughts on that, Steph. It seems to me really, really tragic.
Well, it's again the same thing as it's, and, you know, when we briefly, or probably we all spoke about it, about what you value, you know, like I was at a discussion last week again with people in the Kimberley, you know, as they're fighting for their river up there. And we heard of New Zealand where their river has been given, you know, the value which is a living thing, you know, so it has its own rights. And so, you know, that's what I'd like for our river, you know, that it's been there and a part of this, you know, the way that we think for these tens of thousands of years, and yet again someone can come in and put a different value on it, you know, like And you think all across the world, you know, we use water right in a whole range of nations as something that is that spiritual sense, you know, in a whole range of rituals worldwide. Water is used in whatever form that you see and is appreciated in that sort of instance. And so, and we understand we can sing to water. Do you know what I mean? That the song that lies within water is precious. And I mean, you know, in these times, I don't know, for some, you know, others in the group, but if you look at meditation, there's a whole range of people just listening to water run. If you go into a place where there's, you know, water's just running, or people having, you know, and we do that through our computers where we're cutting it off just down the road, you know, like, so if water's used to heal us, we should be healing water as well. You know, it's a reciprocal thing. For some reason, humans see that they are, you know, much better than everything else, including the land and everything that's within it, you know. Whereas we're only part of this world, we're here for a very short time. And so in that reciprocity of things, we should be looking after and caring for the river just as it cares for us.
I wonder with one of the things the film centers for me is that the Basin Plan in a lot of ways misses some of the key truths of the river. And you see it especially when it talks about the Menindee Lakes, which has been a meeting place for 23,000 years. And there's discussion of emptying it out quickly so that less water evaporates, so that more water can be stored upstream, stolen upstream. And I guess one of the things, it seems in missing those truths, I think it calls on a lot of us to be students in some respect of this other way of understanding our relationship to water and to the river system. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that as an educator, Kanti Seth. What's the attitude for being a good student in this respect, and what are those conditions that make for good learning?
It's like anything, isn't it? It's a sense of listening, you know, like those who have the capability to listen well and take time actually learn so much. And we know that those people who are the best listeners in our world, that have spent all their lives in this presence of listening to others with humility, are the people that we look for as far as humanity and being humble and being able to, you know, bring people along. Your greatest gift is listening and the ability to listen to country deeply. You know, there's people like Rosalie Monks, you know, who speaks of deep listening. And so the river has its own voice, like they say. It tells you things and it knows things that we don't know because we have only been here a short time. It's been here all that time. And so what occurs and what grows and what we, you know, forms on the floodplains is special. You know, that those insects, those birds, those plants have all seen things long before us. So if the first thing we did is sit and listen, and often that's, I suppose, and it looks like a few of us have come to a certain age where the hair grows grey and it's something that we do, I think, value a bit more, isn't it? You know, whether it be listening to the joy of our grandchildren when they laugh or you know, sitting around with long-term friends and talking about those things that we really appreciate. And somehow we have to get those that are in power to actually have some humility about that they don't understand. And I think that's one of the major problems. They believe they have the answers to fix this, and so they look at it as a problem rather than coming and listening to us, rather than giving us any sort of respect in the space.
Mm. You know, I think there's something really important here in that don't understand line. So we were doing a Q&A after a screening in Castlemaine back in, what was it, February? And news was coming through as we talked about where the water was, because there'd been big rains up in Queensland and there was excitement. Oh, the water's reached Wilcannia. Is it there yet? Yes, it is. You know, it was sort of a minute-by-minute story. And we're up on the stage talking, you know, this is all happening. And finally, we all got excited because the water got to Wentworth. But this misses the point completely. The water in the channel got to Wentworth. Yay. That's a good thing. But the floodplain, nowhere outside of Queensland did that floodplain get flooded. The floodplain left was, you know, all that extra water was harvested and put in dams for the growing of cotton. All of those trillions of organisms that depend on that water for their existence missed out. And we all thought it was a great thing. Yeah, there's water in the river and it's going down. But that's only a part of the story. So we're not understanding what a river is. This very white fellow way of seeing what a river is a channel and it's got water in it, if you're lucky. You know, doesn't cover off on what a river truly is. A river is a much bigger thing, and a river floods and it's dynamic and it comes and goes. It's stochastic. It responds to, you know, the weather, to rain events, to dry times, to heat, to cold. The river is this great big dynamic existence, and it pulls together literally trillions of organisms, and humans are only one tiny part of that. And yet, a tiny part of the humans is prepared to destroy the whole thing for money. Yay.
I wonder if that's a... Jono's, this is an interesting point to sort of link to your experience working in and around a lot of your organizing around Barma National Forest, which is one site I think that really exemplifies the impacts of what you're talking about, Peter, about the changing way we operate rivers and the way it looks more like a plumbing infrastructure than a natural system sometimes. And the film focuses a lot on the Baca Darling. But Jono, I'm wondering if you could talk to some of the interconnections for how the impacts there relate to a lot of Victoria and Victoria's tributaries.
Gosh, that's a big question. So for those of you who don't know, Barma Millewa is the world's biggest river red gum forest, and it's right in the centre of Yorta Yorta country. And it exists as that particular kind of ecosystem because of the river. The river is naturally constricted there, and the river spills out as a result across the floodplain. And I guess that's relevant because actually in the southern basin, in sort of southern New South Wales and Victoria and South Australia along the Murray, the damage that was done to our rivers happened so much earlier than the damage that we're talking about on the Darling. You know, we started tipping the way the rivers flowed in terms of the season, you know, big flows in spring and low flows in summer. We started tipping that on its head 100 years ago with weirs and locks and dams. And we cleared the land, with devastating effect. On Yorta Yorta country, Wamba Wamba country, Wadi Wadi country, Barapa Barapa country, around that sort of central riverina district, is some of the most cleared catchments in the entire of Australia. And yet, sitting in the middle of it is this huge forest, heartland country for Yorta Yorta people. And it's there because the river is so powerful, despite all the interventions we made in order, you know, to support the booming of irrigation, we couldn't stop it flooding that forest. We couldn't keep the water in the river channel because the river is so narrow there naturally. And so it's become one of these last vestiges of a cultural and ecological landscape that has otherwise been just wiped off. Wiped off not quite the history books because First Nations people remember, has literally been wiped out in so many places because it is the most devastated landscape and such a scarred river. What's frightening to me in the stories that the film lays out is how quickly that's happened in the Darling. You know, in the Murray, you know, that's sort of happened over 180, 200 years. The river regulation was 100 years, but the clearing began before that. In the Darling system, in the Darling Barker system, a lot of that damage has happened almost since the basin plan. Now, that's an overstatement. There was clearing, you know, there was over-extraction. But, you know, that great theft of Aboriginal land and resources that happened largely in the past, I guess, down in the southern basin has happened, is almost accelerating in the northern basin. This is a very long way around to answering your question, but I guess there are connections there in that we can learn from what is happening, what happened in the south and what's happening in the north. And one of the powerful things I think in the film is that it is much easier to mobilise people power around an immediate loss, an immediate outrage. And that's the power of this story and the power of Barkindji and Gamilaroi and other First Nations coming together and saying, this is unjust and we have to stop this now. That's not at all to diminish the extraordinary work that traditional owners along the Murray have done to stand up and fight for a better river along with their conservation allies. But I guess what's happened in the South is something we sadly haven't learned from, but it's not too late, because the ecological damage that has occurred, that is occurring in the Darling now, is easier to restore because it's, some of it is so recent. It's harder to restore a landscape that has been cleared for 100 years. So that's kind of the, I suppose, the more political connections. In terms of the physical connections, when we choke the Darling up and the Darling stops flowing into the Murray, that has extraordinary ramifications. The Darling provides a huge volume of water to the Murray system. It provides a huge volume of water that is necessary. It often flows when there's less flow in the Murray, and that means it's a bit of a lifeline in the driest times for particularly the South Australian sections when you get down into Nurrungjeri country. But it's also, you know, interconnected. The Darling Anna Branch is one of the great remaining native fish nurseries of the whole river system, and the populations of native fish along the Murray, a lot of them really rely on that Darling Anna Branch to go and breed and you know, repopulate their numbers for the health of the Murray system. So the interconnections are many, both political and ecological and cultural.
And you spent a lot of time organizing around Brahma Forest, and I'm wondering if you had a chance in some of that organizing work, or to do some of that deep listening that Steph's talking about. I've always found that working with other people and being called to put yourself in a position of solidarity with people and with landscape evokes that sort of different position, if that makes sense. I don't know. Do you think there's a way to do that through campaigning? And yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, my story of becoming a campaigner is just one of starting out with an itch that I needed to scratch, which was I knew the place that I loved, you know, this country that we live on, had been stolen from somebody else, and that I, you know, had a moral obligation to do something about that. And I heard about this campaign in the, you know, led by Yorta Yorta people and with environment groups being a part of it. That was taking place not far from where I grew up, because I grew up just upstream of Burma. And it was through that experience of working together with people that I, you know, developed a belief that actually the world isn't on a one-way trajectory to disaster. We can actually right wrongs. We can change the course of history through working together. And I learned so much from, I guess, the resilience and creativity and power of particularly Yorta Yorta people who I worked most closely with, who, you know, had fought 19 separate land rights claims and are still going, you know, from the days of demanding a tax be put on to the paddle steamers, on every paddle steamer going through their country, because they were saying, this is damaging our fisheries. You know, they'd been there fighting and they're now starting to win. And that was just such a deeply empowering experience that I'm so grateful for, and that is making lives better and restoring the river and that beautiful country.
So, Steph, I'm interested in thinking about the same sorts of questions. You've talked about how when you learn something different, how it affects your way of thinking, and how people need to learn how to listen differently. And I'm interested with sort of the reconciliation work you're doing. Do you think that there's a way that sort of listening and solidarity work plays out in on the local level, that can generate the sort of both consciousness, position, and eventually actions we need to restore the river system?
It's again, isn't it, that thing, and I think, you know, when I was sort of saying it's about, you know, the heart and the head, you know, like we talk about often, you know, when you feel something, you know, particularly, you know, I suppose as people who believe they have believe that they're good people, you know, that that they truly want to do something. And if you get to that point and then say, okay, if that's where you stand, why then can we not have a conversation which might get us to think differently, you know, like it's, and so it means that people have to be ready, and this is what we've been doing in Bendigo for the last 3 years at least. We've had conversation circles. And what it is about is often people think, oh, yeah, well, just get in a circle and you yarn, you know, like, you know, that it's an easy process and, you know, oh, yeah, you know, we just sit around and yarn and work. And whereas when you're looking to solve a problem and to sit around and yarn, it's like, and they use some of this within now, you know, healing, you know, if you've got, or even within jails and that's, you know, because this process of being able to come to a circle and find that you have to take responsibility for your own knowledge first, make sure that you are ready to have a conversation and feel uncomfortable, because we can only change if we feel uncomfortable, you know, and that you're ready to have a different view put in front of you, and there's this, you know, this respectful conversation that needs to go, you know, around in this circle. So it's not something that people just see, oh, you just come and you sit and you talk. It really has to be a space when we're looking at yarning and being together, or even in this situation where we're all sitting in our little boxes, that for some reason we've come together, but surely we want to be challenged to make it better for our children and our grandchildren and our children to come, you know. And if I'd probably went to ask everyone, that's what we would be there. We want it to be a healthy, well space, you know, and look across the nation in what we're doing at the moment. That's what we've done for the last, you know, 3 months, trying to grapple and connect with one another. But it shouldn't come to this point. It shouldn't be to this point. We should be ready to do this off our own back and have these conversations, because right before our eyes, like Jonna was saying, you know, like this is happening and we've been fighting for this for a while, but no one will listen. And you know, it's not until someone holds big fish up in front of people that finally people say, okay, we need to act. Because I don't think people really think too much of that muddy water, you know, like whereas when I see flat country and muddy water, my heart just sings. Like my husband laughs at me, you know. I'm not a sea person. I'm not someone who sees those, you know, and anyone that loves the sea, they have that same special connection, isn't it? If you're someone who spends a lot of time in the sea and the sun and you think, oh, that's, well, my heart warms with muddy water, because that's what takes me back to sitting with my mother, to being, I'm one of 14 children, so there's a few of us. And it was a fun time where my sisters and brothers, we used to walk along the river when we weren't fencing or working on the cotton or whatever, you know, we worked pretty hard all the way through. And that's why I went off to university to teach, because it was, I thought that sort of work was pretty hard. But, you know, the river was always that chance to walk along together. And I don't think people, you know, if, you know, you might walk through forest and whatever, but when you walk along the river, it's a different experience again, you know. I would encourage people. My father-in-law is Yorta, so he's 84. And a couple of years ago I took four Yorta women for an 80K walk just along the river. And the conversations changed over time, you know. They were quite unfit, and one hadn't camped and hadn't walked in quite a while. I didn't realise that. And I was the oldest in the group, and I was carrying other people's bags and whatever to keep them moving along. And the river was just there. And the conversations just changed over time. Less was worried about, you know, all of our work, and more was worried about just us as women chatting, you know. Like, wouldn't that be lovely just to have more opportunities for us to share together? And that's what that walking along the river does for us. And yet probably people don't think about it enough, I think. But get a group of young kids or young adults near the river. It's just such joy. I don't know who amongst you have had that time, whether it be on the Murray or elsewhere in the country. It mightn't be something that's raging like, you know, some other places in the world, but ours is it's a gentle river. And like the Gamilaroi, I think, yeah, we're warriors, but we are also people who have shown that we are resistant. You know, we look to our country, you know, we were fighters as well. So that's what that river is, a part of us, you know. It's like Pete was saying, you know, people are draining our lives, you know, like. Yeah.
So getting towards the end, and I guess I'm wondering, thinking to maybe go around for closing thoughts, I'm wondering, thinking about the different ways the situation can improve, whether it's recognition of the river as a legal entity, whether it's a royal commission, whether it's wholeheartedly implementing the basin plan or something else. What do you all think is the next step we need to take together? And maybe if you have any ideas of what the next, maybe most graceful step people could take as individuals or with their friends and family. Peter, it's a big question.
Tyler, it's a really big thing, but if I had my way, we would be declaring the Barka and all of her tributaries to be a legal person, to give them the rights that they are due as a person. It's not new. It's been done for the Whanganui River in New Zealand. I think it's a long shot. It's in reach, but only to our fingertips at the moment. But if we really want reconciliation in this country, if we really want things to change, if we really want an environment for our grandchildren, then this is the way forward. Let's recognise that river and all of its tributaries as a person, give them rights. And then we can actually move away from the values that says money is the only thing. The neoliberal way of looking at the world that just reduces everything to the bottom line can just be left in the history books where it belongs. And we have a chance to re-engage in what Thomas Berry called the great conversation. You know, humanity is not separate from nature. Humanity is a part of nature. What happens to nature happens to us. And you know, we do it to ourselves if we destroy these places. So yeah, that's my future. And I'll step aside and let other people talk.
Maybe Jana, do you have any ideas?
Gosh, it is a big question. You know, I think underlying all of this is how powerful we believe we are and we can be by working together. You know, I think positive changes have happened, but more negative ones have washed over the top of them because we were not organised enough and vocal enough. You know, the Water Act, for all its flaws and you know, including that fundamental racism that underlies it, which, let's be honest, underlies every single piece of environmental legislation in Australia. For all of that, the Water Act is a huge improvement on what was there before, because at its heart, it actually says you have to take into account the needs of the river. In fact, you have to figure out what the river needs, and then if there's anything left over, you can take it out for commercial use. The difference between what the Water Act says and what's happening is a lack of people power. Because government agencies have been essentially captured by the irrigation lobby, and so they haven't implemented what they are legally required to do. And that's what the South Australian Royal Commission found. But, you know, that achievement only 15 years ago of that Water Act was a profound victory in itself, and we just have to keep fighting. So I think we need to do that. We need to learn from the mistakes that we've made in the past. We didn't, I think, reach out and work with the people who are most impacted by this. First Nations people, but every resident of the basin as well, have been impacted. You know, the handful who have profited from the shoddy implementation of the basin plan, you know, are a tiny minority, and they've absolutely ripped the guts out of the rest of their community, white and black. And we need to just actually, you know, lay that truth bare and demand justice.
What do you think, Steph? Do you have any closing thoughts?
I got Linda Smith spoke from New Zealand about their river and she just said act and then, you know, get ready for the fight. So we just need to act, you know, like, and with the help of people like Jono, you know, there's like I said, there's already a group of Indigenous women looking at, you know, as a women's alliance. So, you know, for us to meet with those people and, you know, there's others, like there was a couple of uncles talking the other night on the other time, you know, Pete on our other discussions. And, you know, it's about bringing those people there together and being behind those voices, you know, who love the river. When you love something, you know, no matter what people challenge you about, you'll just fight for it. And so, you know, this is an opportunity for people to really get together on it, you know, all the way along. And those stories that are there all the way along, you know, they've been shared. You can hear each of those stories all the way through. You know.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of work to be done. No shortage of work, I think. One of the things, we're about to post a link in the chat. There are things in this that'll take a long time in this fight, and I think that there's a lot of different fights that are part of reviving the river system and restoring justice to the way water's held and the way that water is managed. One of the things that we've been talking with allies across the basin about recently are some of those reforms that can happen really soon and would make a big impact. And one of the main ones that's been coming up is that water that's been clawed back, irrigation licenses that have been bought back for the purpose of the environment, repurposed for filling wetlands and keeping rivers flowing. Some of those requirements are overdue. And there's just a shortage of those buybacks that need to happen, and the government can go out tomorrow and start open tender buyback and get things back on track. And it's one piece of the puzzle, but it's an important piece to get things moving. So feel free to sign the petition and you'll get updates for all the work that's happening in the conversations that we'll hopefully have into the future. Send us any feedback you have on this, and you'll be getting a follow-up email as well, talking about some things you can do to help engage. I'd like to thank the panelists, Peter, Auntie Steph, and Jono. Thank you guys for taking the time to join, and thank you everyone else for hopping on. Talk to you all soon.
Thanks, Tyler. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye. Steph.